Our topic today is corruption, bribery, kickbacks, self-dealing, and so on. Perhaps surprisingly, outside the specific area of bribery, there's not that much systematic halachic discussion of corruption in general. In this share, we'll survey the literature on honest dealing and self-dealing, the literature of which I am aware. Much of the discussion begins with a tshuva of the Maharam of Rottenburg. Maharam of Rottenburg is a seminal tshuva on what to do. Local government, a city, people in a city are trying to decide on some joint project to hire somebody, a rav, a chazan for the city, build something, and they can't reach a consensus, they can't reach a unanimous decision. So what do? Maharam says, you vote. The people, the taxpayers get together, discussion the later poskim, do non-taxpayers not get any vote at all, but taxpayers, Maharam says, get together and they vote and they follow the majority opinion. And the Maharam says, he adds a crucial condition. He says, the people voting, they have to be makabel under penalty of cherem that they're going to express their opinion l'shem shemayim. They have to say that they have to vote l'shem shemayim. What exactly does that mean? Let's say the city is voting on a question of building a wall, and somebody's in the construction business. Does he have to set aside his personal financial picture and say, I'm just going to vote on whether I think the city needs a wall or not, independent of my personal interest? Maybe he should recuse himself. Rabbi Eliezer Gordon of Telz talks about a case where people were voting, the city was voting about a rav. He wants to know if relatives of one of the candidates for the position were allowed to vote. He brings them around. They have to vote l'shem shemayim. Surely people are partial toward their relatives. Can they really vote l'shem shemayim? Nevertheless, in his case at least, he argues that they could. Other posts can say they can't. Different Mochiel says relatives cannot vote because they're no gimbadavar. They're interested parties in the outcome of the election. But Rav Gordon says that they may vote, and he makes a couple of arguments. One of them is, he says, really one could argue that why should people, residents of a city, have to vote l'shem shemayim? They're like partners, he says. They're partners in municipal affairs. Let's say partners are voting on the direction the business should take. A partner doesn't have to express his opinion l'shem shemayim. A partner can vote for whatever he thinks is in the best interest of the business and, by extension, his own best interest. There's no rule about voting l'shem shemayim. So why should people in the city have to vote l'shem shemayim? At one point, he suggests it's a takana, because it's possible for them to set aside their personal opinions. The Chachamim wanted them to vote l'shem shemayim to the extent that they can. So he says, we make everybody commit himself to vote l'shem shemayim to the extent possible. And we tell the relatives as well. We tell them, you have to try, do your best, try to set aside your personal partiality for your relative and try to vote for what you think is in the best interest of the city. In Okinami, we recognize that it's impossible for them to be totally impartial. And all we require them to do is, it's only a takana, we require them to do whatever they can to the extent that they can. More than that, they don't have to do. In his particular case, he has an additional argument for leniency. He says that the candidates were all qualified. It was just a question of preference, which one will we take? He says it wasn't a question of better or worse for the city. So it's not as important to have l'shem shemayim. They're both good, objectively. Just a question of who do you want, so even relatives can vote. But I'll call upon him, this is the ruling of Maharam of Rottenburg, that people have to vote l'shem shemayim, even... We'll discuss this again as we go, but even apparently private citizens, not just public officials, have to vote l'shem shemayim. Even ordinary voters, members or residents of a city who are voting on a matter of public interest, have to commit themselves to vote l'shem shemayim. Another very important tshuva is a tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshen. Trumas Hadeshen was asked about, there was a certain member of the city who had been guilty of perjury. He had taken a shvua sheker, he had been fined and been forced to pay apparently a significant fine because of his sin, his criminal act. Subsequently, the community had made its peace with him, and they wanted to appoint him to a position of authority, a public position, one of the Tuvei HaKahal, the leaders of the community. They wanted to know if there's any reason they can't appoint this person with this criminal record, so to speak, to a position of importance. Trumas Hadeshen says he is ineligible, he may not be appointed. Why? So he says, Dayanim certainly have rules, a Dayan has to be kosher. He says a Dayan has many qualifications. Even though this person wasn't going to be a Dayan, he was going to be one of the Tuvei HaKahal, one of the leaders of the community, says in Trumas Hadeshen, people who are appointed to positions of public trust, of public power, he says, Tuvei Ha'er, when they sit l'fakeach aliskei rabim to attend to public matters v'yichidim b'makom based in kaimi. They have the status of dayanim. A tremendous chiddush that the qualifications of dayanim extend to other types of governmental officials as well, not just dayanim. Since a dayan, a rasha can't be a dayan, someone who committed certain types of averus is possible to be a dayan, he can't be appointed, can't be elected or appointed to a position of public authority as well. Both these tshuvas, that of Maram of Rattenberg and that of the Truma Sedeshin, are brought by the Ramah, Maram in Siman Kuf Samach Gimel in Choshen Mishpat, the Truma Sedeshin in Siman Lamed Zayin. These two things are paskin lahalacha. This Truma Sedeshin that we expect people in positions of public authority to have the status of dayanim, and this is something that comes up in the context of voting, of elections, modern democracy. Some have argued that anyone who can't be a dayan can't hold public office in general. When the question of female suffrage came up, of whether a woman can vote, whether a woman should be able to hold public positions, positions of governmental positions, one of the arguments made, Rabbi Elazar Prial made this point, was that Truma Sedeshin tells us that any position of public authority has to have the qualifications of dayanim. If a woman can't be a dayan, then she can't have she can't be appointed to public positions as well. Again, if you really take this literally, it would follow that anyone who's not shomer Torah mitzvahs can't have a public position, and that's, you know, obviously that would be a big chiddush. But this is what the Truma Sedeshin and the Ramah rule, that someone who is not qualified to be a dayan can't have a position of public authority as well. There are other poskim also who make the general point that the stringent criteria of dayanim have to be extended to other types of public governmental officials as well. In the Papula Charifta, he also says that Nemanim al Tzibur, different types of public officials, also have the status of dayanim. He's talking about with respect to Shochet, respect to the prohibition against taking bribes. He brings a Gemara and a Rush. The Gemara talks about a case where Rav Abba Bar Yaakov was once asked by the Reish Galusa to determine whether a certain defendant, a man named Bar Chama, who had committed a serious crime, there was a question as to whether Bar Chama should be severely punished, either executed or punished in some significant way. He had killed somebody. The Reish Galusa asked Rav Abba Bar Yaakov, go see what his din should be. So there was a long discussion they had about Hilchas Eidus, technical rules of the laws of Eidus. Eventually, Rav Abba Bar Yaakov acquitted this Bar Chama. So Bar Chama was so grateful, Nashke Akare, he kissed his feet, and he accepted to pay to settle the tax of Rav Abba Bar Yaakov for the rest of his life, Kol Yomav, out of gratitude to the Dayan having acquitted him. So the Rush is bothered. This sounds like Shochet, paying a Dayan money for a favorable ruling. That sounds like bribery. Even though it was after the fact over here, Shochet Meuchar, paying a Dayan a bribe even after the verdict, is still awesome. So the Rush says, really, a Talmid Chacham are potter from taxes anyway. That's a halacha and Baba Basra. Talmid Chacham are not obligated to pay taxes. So he wasn't really giving him a bribe because he was really potter from paying taxes anyway. Says the Papula Charifta, you see from the Rush that the Rush was bothered that this would have constituted Shochad, even though they weren't doing Din Torah. There's no Mises based on Bizman Azeh. This was some kind of quasi-judicial or extrajudicial proceeding. It wasn't really Mishpatei HaTorah. Afal Pikein, the laws of Shochad apply. One could argue, you see the Gemara at great length goes through a whole sugya of the laws of Eidus, of the halachas of Eidus, so they were clearly being done to some extent al pi dinei Torah. It was somewhat judicial, but Papula Charifta understands this was not really a judicial proceeding. Nevertheless, the laws of Shochet apply, and therefore Papula Charifta says, I'm telling you this, he says, I'm writing this down so you should know that Nemanim al Tzibur, people in positions of public trust, of public authority, even though they're not dayanim, they're not doing din Torah, nevertheless, they have to be careful to avoid Shochet. We find the same thing in the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan says the laws of Shochet are not limited to Dayanim. They apply to anyone appointed and over the Tzibur, anyone involved in public affairs, even though they're not doing Din Torah. They cannot be partial. They cannot tilt the Din toward their friends or against their enemies. He says, Kol Shkein, they can't take Shochet. So a number of poskim, beginning with the Truma Sedeshin, make the basic point that the laws of Shochad and the laws of Dayanim in general, the laws of being an Ish Kasher, apply not just to Dayanim, but to public officials as well. What we would call legislators or members of the executive, people in positions of trust and authority, have some of the stringent halachas of Dayanim as well. Based on based on these rulings of Maram of Rattenberg, that people who vote on a matter of public interest have to express their opinion l'shem shamayim, and the ruling of the Truma Sedeshen, that people who vote on matters of public interest have to be kasher for dayanim, the Chasam Sofer has a very important and far-reaching ruling. Chasam Sofer was talking about a case where there was an election for Rav in a city. There were several candidates, and the procedure they were using was a series of up-down votes on candidates in sequence. They would vote up or down the first candidate, they would vote up or down the second candidate, the third candidate. The first one to be voted up would be elected. How they decided who would be voted on first, I'm not sure. But this was how they decided to vote, a series of binary up-down votes on the candidate. The first one lost, the second one lost, the third one won. And then a great scandal broke. There were accusations, it wasn't clear if they were proven, there were accusations that vote buying had occurred, that the third winning candidate himself or his friends and family had paid members of the community to vote on behalf of their candidate. So there was a tremendous controversy about this, a tremendous social controversy in the city. The matter came to the Chasam Sofer for a halachic ruling. And he discusses the question of, is this proven or not? What are the standards of proof we require? Without getting into questions of evidence and proof, what happens, assuming we take as given that the vote buying occurred, says the Chasam Sofer, the vote is void. Why is it void? The Maram says, people have to express their opinion l'shem shamayim. And if you sell your vote, then you sell your vote to the highest bidder, and then you're obviously not expressing your opinion l'shem shamayim anymore. You're a mercenary vote at that point. And the Truma Sedeshen says that people who vote on a question of public interest have to meet the qualifications of dayanim. And certainly if you're a dayan who's even paid to do din, his din is batel. Even if he's not bribed, certainly if he's bribed, if he accepts shochad, his din is batel. So these people who were paid to vote, their vote is batel, based on the Maram, based on the Truma Sedeshen. Now the Chasam Sofer is saying a tremendous chiddush, because the Truma Sedeshen was talking about public officials, tuvei hakahal, namanim al hakahal, people in positions of governmental authority. The Chasam Sofer was talking about ordinary citizens in a community who were voting on who to appoint as a rav. In American law, certainly, there's a tremendous difference between, even though vote buying is illegal, even for ordinary voters, you can't sell your vote, you can't buy a vote, even an ordinary voter, but people in public positions have much more stringent requirements about conflicts of interest and so on. There's no law that says, it's certainly, whatever the Maram says about L'shem Shamayim and Halacha, we have a higher standard, but there's no law in American law, neither the Maram nor the Truma Sedeshen applies. A person, an ordinary elector, an ordinary citizen, when I vote for president or for governor or for dog catcher, there's no obligation I have to vote l'shem shamayim. I have every right to vote for, well, I can vote for myself if I want. President, you vote for yourself. You can vote for your friend. You can vote for whoever's policy you think will benefit your business. You have certainly no legal obligation to vote l'shem shamayim for the best interest of the country. We encourage it as a civic duty maybe, but it's not strictly an obligation. And the Truma Sedeshen as well. There's certainly no obligation that a person who wants to vote be rated as well qualified by the American Bar Association or even meet the legal standards for judges. There's simply no such rule. Certainly in American law, in modern law, we treat ordinary electors much more loosely, much more leniently than we treat actual judges and people in public positions. But the Chasam Sofer understood the Maram himself was certainly talking about ordinary electors, and even the Truma Sedeshen was talking about people in positions of authority, and said that someone who is a Rasha who committed a crime is not eligible to be appointed as a dayan or even a public official. Truma Sedeshen didn't say that he can't vote even as a private citizen, but Chasam Sofer seems to say, at least with regard to vote buying, we apply the Truma Sedeshen even with regard to private citizens. If you accept that, it would seem to follow that someone who's a Russia loses the right to vote. Felons, we have a question in this country whether felons can vote. According to Chasam Sofer, that he extends the Truma Sedeshen to ordinary voters, it would seem that anyone who's a felon can't vote. We talked before about women. Women is a question that came up, whether women can vote. But the felons can't vote. People who are not Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs wouldn't be able to vote, according to this rule. Unclear how far the Chasam Sofer would take this. But in any event, he rules that both the Maram, who was clearly talking about private citizens, applied to his case, and even the Truma Sedeshen, the rule that you have to be kosher to be a dayan, also applies to private electors. And therefore, in an ordinary election for a municipal matter, if the person doesn't express his opinion l'shem shamayim, it's not valid, and if you're bribed, it's not l'shem shemayim. And similarly, if you're not qualified to be a dayan because you've been bribed, that's another reason why the vote is void, and the vote has to be redone. Incidentally, we should mention, Truman Sedeshin said that someone who is a Rasha, someone who committed an Avera, is no longer eligible to hold public office. We do believe in tshuva. There is such a thing as rehabilitation via repentance. That's true. But the point is, tshuva has very, very rigorous standards. Tshuva doesn't just mean that you stood on Yom Kippur and you cried. Tshuva in this context means you meet certain very concrete and formal conditions for it to be considered proper tshuva. In the Truman Sedeshin's case, they hadn't met that standard of tshuva. And so, and Chacham Sofer is telling us that if your vote was paid for, at least if it was paid for in this particular vote, you do not satisfy the Maram's rule of voting L'shem Shemayim, neither do you satisfy the Truman Sedeshin's rule of being kosher to be a dayan, and therefore in his case, he dismissed the vote as void. Vitzchak Zilberstein discusses the case of, again, also municipal officials who were elected and then it turned out that they or their agents had bought votes, had paid people in the city to vote for them. He doesn't seem to have seen the Chasam Sofer, he doesn't bring it, but based on a comment of the Chazar Nish, he rules as follows. If the people who won the election based on bribery are not qualified, then the vote is certainly void and their election is null and void. Even if they are qualified, but if there are those who are more qualified than them, so they're not the best candidates for the job, and they were elected via bribery, then again, their election is null and void. If they are as good as any other candidate, then even though bribery occurred, then their election stands and is not void. Hard to know exactly how you decide if they're the best candidates or not. In modern democracy, that's what voting is for. Voting is to decide who the best candidate is. If you already know who the best candidate is, why would you bother to vote if that's an objectively determinable question? So I don't know, but I'll call upon him. That's what he says, that if they are the best candidates, the bribery does not invalidate their election. If they're not qualified, or even if they are qualified but not the best candidates, then their election is void. Again, Chasam Sofer seems to say the vote is void always, regardless, without any question of is he the best candidate or not, simply because they did not express their opinion l'shem shemayim and because they were bribed, so they're not kosher as they are. Rav Zilberstein, though, says it depends whether they're the inferior candidates or unqualified candidates or not. Tshura Shai, Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, talks about a case of the Zayin Tuvei HaKahal, the seven leaders of the community. They were voting on whether to impose a certain tax on wine. Now, one of the seven Tuvei Ha'er was a wine merchant. Now, for some reason, that doesn't seem to have occurred to anybody that he should be disqualified from this vote or have to recuse himself, despite the fact that he was a wine merchant. I don't know why people didn't raise this objection that he can't vote on a matter in which he has a personal interest. Note that Yehuda says that, of course, Tuvei Ha'er have no authority on matters in which they have a personal interest. For some reason, he was going to be entitled to vote, even though he had a financial stake in the outcome of the vote. I really don't understand why. But somebody in the community was concerned about this and wanted to make sure that he would not vote in his personal interest. So he bribed that one of the Zayin Tuvei Ha'er to vote in favor of the tax, despite his personal financial stake. So he did, and he voted in favor. And it turned out all seven of the Zayin Tuvei Ha'er voted in favor of the tax. Unanimous. After that, after the vote, the fact of the bribery came to light that one of the seven votes had been bought. The question was, is that grounds for overturning the entire decision? So you might argue, no, because Dalmehaf of this one, even excluding this one, I have six other votes, so six out of seven is going to win regardless of what this guy voted. Maybe he even wasted his money on buying the seventh one if all six turned out to vote, the other six voted the right way anyway. Says it's Shurashai, nope. The vote is void anyway. Why? So he gives two reasons. The first reason he gives is, there is discussion in the poskim. Whenever you have a body that's empowered to make decisions, do you need what is a quorum? Do you need the presence of the full membership? You follow Rove, but you have to have the full membership there or not. So that's a discussion in the poskim. And the Shurashai says that even if we say we don't need the full quorum present, that's because in the interest of efficiency and of not having endless trouble getting all the members together, the community agrees for pragmatic reasons we don't have to have a full quorum. But in a case, the quorum doesn't have to be the full membership of the body. But in a case where one of them was bribed, people never had any minhag, there was never any intention to allow to allow a vote to take place when some members are not just absent because they're out of town, but absent because they're bribed and corrupted, there's no such minute. So in that case, we simply lack a quorum, and therefore the whole vote is void. Even more interestingly, more acutely, he says the problem with shochad is that it's contagious. Shochad is not limited to the person who actually took the bribe. He brings from the targum on the pasuk ki ashochad yaverine pikhim bisalef divrei tzadikim. He brings that the targum Yonason says the shochad losikach ki ashochad yaver pikhim. So the shochad says that the shochad is mesameine nosvay. It blinds the eyes of people who accept it. And also, also it corrupts other chacham. Shurashai explains that means the contagion spreads. Once his opinion is changed, he can then persuade others to vote like him. So the insidiousness of shochad is that it can spread beyond. You can get it has a multiplier effect beyond the person whose vote you bought. You're essentially buying and influencing other votes as well. So who knows? That Shurashai says perhaps if this guy hadn't been bought, he might have voted the other way, and he might have been persuasive and eloquent in explaining why the tax is a bad idea, and they all would have agreed. So the shochad corrupts the entire body, and therefore the entire vote is void, even though only one was bribed. Now the Chasam Sofer doesn't seem to hold like that, because the Chasam Sofer said, in his case also, he did say that even if only a minority of the electors were bribed, then the vote is void. He gave a reason. He said because by the time they got to the third candidate, he was the only one left, or one of the only one or two left, so people who didn't really want to vote for him because their candidate was voted down by the corrupt electors, they voted for the third one. But had the corrupt electors never voted against the first ones, they could have voted for the first ones. So the Chasam Sofer also says the vote is void, but only because there is a plausible possibility that had there not been corruption, the outcome would have been different. In a case, he doesn't bring the questions of quorum or the questions of the Churashai about the corruption spreads from one to the other. Perhaps we can distinguish between a case of Tuvei Ha'er, who are voting a deliberative body, where they talk to each other, and a case where the whole city is voting. It does seem intuitively implausible to say that if a single vote is bought in an entire city, the whole vote is void. Every election we have some fraud, but we can't void every election where there's any fraud at all. And even in the age of the internet, one person's opinions are not likely to sway the whole town, so especially if the corruption was limited, and it's a whole city voting, and it's not really a deliberative body anyway. Maybe the Shurashai would agree. Not so clear, but I'll call upon him, in his case at least, of a deliberative body of the Zion Tuvei Ha'er, even a single bought vote is enough to void the whole election, while the Chasam Sofer in his case seemed to feel that a single vote could void the whole election, but only if, based on the circumstances, a minority of bought votes could void the whole election, but only if there's reasonable basis to suggest that might have actually affected the outcome, as he explains in his case. Now, shochad itself, bribery, is absolutely usur. To bribe a Jewish judge, as we've seen, it applies to public officials and electors in general. There is an interesting discussion in the Achronim as to whether the issur of shochad applies to non-Jews. Can a Jew bribe a non-Jewish judge? What's the question? The way the Torah phrases the prohibition of shochad is from the perspective of the Dayan. It says, v'shochad lo sikach. You're not allowed to accept shochad. Now, once the Dayan can't accept shochad, you can't offer shochad either, because that's lifnei iver. You're causing him to sin. The question is, but is a non-Jew commanded in the avera of shochad? Is it one of the Zayin mitzvah ne'inah? Some suggest that it is. It's part of dinim. It's included in the general mitzvah, to be honest, and not steal, and dinim. But the question is there a specific prohibition of shochad for a non-Jew? So the Chavos Yair has a long, fascinating tshuva on this topic. He begins by relating his brother-in-law, Rabbi Itzik Brillin, was friendly with a certain great duke. The great duke apparently was Charles Louis, Carl Ludwig, Elector Palatine, KG. And they used to enjoy, the duke at least used to enjoy the rabbi's company. And the duke once complained to him that you Jews are terrible. You're quarreling all the time. It's not enough that you're clogging my halls of justice, but you're corrupting all my judges because you're bribing them. So the rabbi tried to melam beitzchus on Yisrael, explain why they do it. At one point he said it's because the Christian judge has a natural bias toward his co-religionists, and so if one of the litigants is Gentile and one is Jewish, the judge has an unfair bias toward the Christian, and therefore I'm just trying to even the playing field by bribing. Not I, but that's what they're trying to do. So the Duke said, well, what if both litigants are Jews? So Rav Yitzchak said, well, I have other terutzim that I have over there. So the Duke laughed and says, I know that Shari terutzim, you're always going to have a teretz, bein be'emes, bein b'sheker. But he said, but the Duke said that it's not right. He said it's not an excuse. He says maybe it's he says that they had this debate, and he gives the rabbi gives several explanations. Chalila, it's wrong. He said just the limud zchus, and he says, well, what would you say about he had other explanations of why it's okay. Because it's only the bribe is only to do a good job. I'm just bribing you to make sure that you give my side a fair hearing, and he says that sometimes he knows the other person is bribing him, so he has to just counteract that. He gave all kinds of limudei chus. And what about when they're both Christians? You don't have the svara that it's not fair because the other one's a Christian and you're Jewish. But I have the other teretzim. He said. So he says the Duke laughed and says, Chasdoin milech, you're smart and you're. He says you're speaking well, but he says, you know, I know that there's always going to be terutzim, hein be'emes, hein b'sheker, meaning it's not right, and you should fix this, and you should do something about this. So Chavos Yair says, al pi din, what's the halacha? Al pi din, does the isser, al pi Torah, is there an isser of bribing non-Jews? So the Chavos Yair says, and the Chasam Sofer says something similar, bribing a non-Jewish judge to be matem mishpat, to give you money where you're not entitled to, is certainly wrong. Hatas mishpat, tatias mishpat, distorting the din is certainly usher for the non-Jew. There's no hatchet to do that. However, the Chavos Yair says that there might be basis for leniency in a case where the din is not clear-cut. It's not a question of you're lying and you're claiming something happened that didn't happen. The din itself is genuinely ambiguous when lawyers argue in front of courts. A lawyer can genuinely take both sides of a case because it's not clear-cut and there are arguments to be made on both sides. And in good faith, you're allowed to argue your position even though it's objectively not clear. In such a case, he says, it's not a tias mishpat. Whatever the judge rules is really valid. So in such a case, the Chavos Yair suggests that might be okay, even though you're bribing him, he says, but maybe in such a case where there's no objective truth to which way the din is, not like Torah, he says, which is more objective. Even in Torah, there's some basis for this argument, he says, but certainly with Mishpatei Hanachrim, he says, there is basis to say that it's not a Tias Mishpat, and maybe there's some basis to be lenient, he says, but certainly, he says, Chavos Yair concludes, he says, certainly, if you're asking him to mata the mishpat, he says chas v'shalom. If you know the other person's right, and you're asking the dayan to corruptly rule in your favor, then you have chet kafel meshulash. He says gezel shochad ibus adin, three averes. He says you're stealing, you're over bribery in this case, you're over the hatias mishpat, perversion of the din, and no chiluf in Yisrael b'gai. He says so. Chavos Yair doesn't. It's not really machriya 100% whether there's ever a heter. Rav Batumim says that the Ha'olam Nag in Hector, people are Mekil, and he wants to know why. He says maybe because perhaps the reason is because the Psul of Kurva doesn't apply to non-Jews, and maybe the Shochet doesn't apply either. The Chasam Sofer also has a tshuva about this. He also says that Hatiyas Mishpat is absolutely Usser. Asking the non-Jewish judge to pervert the din is definitely Usser. However, he says sometimes you know that the din is with you. Just you know that the other person's lying, and you can't prove it, maybe, he says, that, or the non-Jewish judge is not investigating the matter properly, he says, or the other person is a non-Jew, like in the case of the Chavos Yair, so he's partial to him. In those cases, he says, then adrabah, by bribing the judge, you're getting the right outcome, and adrabah, you're stopping him from doing a tias mishpat. He would pervert the judgment in favor of the non-Jew. You're just stopping that. So that's adrabah, you matzel him from a tias mishpat. So then he says there would be some basis for leniency. Then it's mutter. Furthermore, he says, in a case where it's a capital crime, then it's always mutter, he says, because a non-Jew never has authority to execute, to impose the death penalty on a Jew. So that's always shalok din, he says. Ein shuma ofen sheba olam, where Yisrael can be chayav misa b'dineim without edim and hasra, and based in of Yisrael, of mumchen, and chav gimel, and therefore anytime they execute a Jew, it's shalok din, and therefore it's mutter to bribe them not to do that. That's actually a very problematic and very controversial thing to say. Because there are other Gemaras, the Gemara of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, and Bav Metzia, that they used to kill Ganavim, and he used to help them catch and kill Ganavim. And many poskim say that was mutter. So there definitely are places in Halacha which indicate that the non-Jews are allowed to have a criminal justice system, even one that involves executing Jews, even in cases where the Halacha does not impose the death penalty, even in cases where procedural conditions for the death penalty, Edom and Hasra, are not met. So there are major sources that non-Jews are allowed to execute Jews, b'dineihem, But the Chasam Sofer here says that's never mutter, and therefore a shochan in such a case would be mutter. There's a fascinating tshuva in the Tshura Shai, another tshuva in the Tshura Shai. He was asked about a person that the government had an asset. It was the bridge toll concession. The government used to collect taxes or tolls. Very often the government didn't want to collect it itself, so it would sell the right to collect the toll to some businessman who would pay the government a fixed fee, and he would have the right to collect whatever he took. Now, the government had a rule that this asset, this tax right, this toll right, had to be auctioned off at a free and fair public auction with proper announcement beforehand. A certain Jew didn't want to pay fair market price for it, so he bribed some of the local officials to give it to him in a sweetheart deal without going through, happens all the time, without going through the proper rules, and essentially he was defrauding the government of its, defrauding the government. He paid government officials a bribe to do this. Someone else found out and went over his head and told the higher-ups what was going on. There was corruption, and he wanted to buy it at its fair price. The first guy had the chutzpah to take the second guy to Beis Din and say, Ani Malek Becharara, I was here first, unfair competition, you should have left this to me. So the Tshura Shai dismisses the claim on the grounds that when you're doing an avla, when you're doing an avera, when you're stealing and behaving unethically, Chazal didn't give you protections of Anim Hapik B'Charara. So therefore, this first guy was doing an avla by bribing the officials to give it to him at an unfairly low price, and therefore he can't claim Anim Hapik B'Charara. Why was he doing an avla? So he lists off a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, he says it's Shochat. And he says Shochat applies to non-Jews as well. And again, even though here we're not dealing with judges, we've already seen that Shochat applies outside the judicial context, as well as the judicial itself. Second, it's Gezel, he says. You're stealing from the government. You're stealing government property. Even though some poskim say, in some case, hafkas halva, sometimes it's mutter, he says, but with governments it's more strict, that some say there's no hafkas halva to the government. Even if you'll tell me, according to some opinions, maybe there's no Gezel for the government, he says, but there's Gezel from every person you collect the toll from, because you certainly don't have the right to this toll. If you didn't pay the fair price for it, you certainly are not entitled to it. So you have no right to collect tolls. Every toll that you collect is gezel from the person who pays it. And the fourth svara, he says, the most interesting and the most powerful argument he makes, the most broad-ranging, is that it's gezel from the Jewish community, he says, because Jews have a stake in government as well. So you're not just stealing from the non-Jewish government. Jews pay taxes. Jews benefit from public services. By stealing from the government, you're stealing from the Jewish community. You're stealing their stake in the public coffers. Public works, public taxes. Both points, he says. First of all, they benefit from the government's infrastructure and so on. They build roads and so on. And second, if the government doesn't have enough revenue, they have to raise taxes on everyone, including the Jews. You're affecting other Jews. That's called stealing from Jews. All the poskim, he said, who had certain leniencies about non-Jewish governments, must have been talking about cases where the government collected taxes for the personal enrichment of the king. But when it's for the public good, you're stealing from other Jews, he says. There's no heter. So for a variety of reasons, he says, paying a bribe to a government official to let you have government assets at below market price is usur for a variety of reasons. In terms of kickbacks, in terms of somebody taking a kickback for work he does for somebody else, not that much discussion of which I'm aware. Divrei Chaim, the Chaim of Sanz, Chaim Halberstam of Sanz, talks about a case where there was a court-appointed guardian who was supposed to rent out the property owner's property. So he did so. But instead of renting it out for the fair price, let's say for $100, he rented it out for a below market price. He gave somebody a sweetheart deal for $70, let's say, for a kickback. The guy agreed to pay him $10 under the table. So it was a win-win for both of them. The guy would end up paying only $80 instead of $100. The agent would pocket $10, a win-win for both of them. The one who lost, obviously, was the property owner who was being defrauded out of 20%. That those are not his actual numbers, but was being defrauded out of 20% of the fair market value of his house. In the case of the Divrei Chaim, he says that the agent was pocketing 30 rubles because of tirchasa upachta, because of my trouble in doing this corruption for you and my fear of getting caught. If I get caught, I'm in trouble. So the Divrei Chaim discusses how Halacha would view this. His case was somewhat more complicated, but to simplify a little bit, he says, at one point, he said, this is Gezel Gomer, he says. He says, the house was worth whatever it was worth, say $100, he says, 100 rubles. If you only gave the person 70, and you gave the $10 kickback to the agent, he says, What that means is you're simply stealing some of the rent and putting it in your pocket. The rent should have been 100. Anything less than 100 that you keep, you're simply stealing rent and siphoning it off for yourself, he says. So if the landlord gets wind of this, he says, he has an option. He can either void the whole lease because an agent who deviates so significantly from his instructions, who behaves dishonestly, the landlord has the option of simply voiding the lease and saying, get lost, this was not done under my authority. Or he says, if he prefers, he can say, turn over the kickback to me, because the kickback is simply, you can call it a commission if you want, he says, but it's not a commission. You simply stole some of the rent and put it in your pocket. What's the difference if you charged 100 and then you simply pocketed 10 and told me that 20, whatever it is, and said you only got this much? What's the difference if you simply said the rent to 70 and you put 10 in your own pocket? He doesn't make that exact analogy, but basically he says this is simply a question of gezel. You're simply a kickback that you took in exchange for disposing of the assets of the principal for less than their fair market value. That is simply theft, and the owner of the property has the right to that kickback. The Divrei Malkiel also discusses a case of a kickback. He was discussing the sale of a rabbinic position. That used to be the custom. The outgoing Rav would sell the right to the position to the incoming Rav for a certain price, and then the incoming Rav would be entitled to the position. In the Divrei Malkiel's case, the outgoing Rav was making Aliyah, and the terms of the deal he made with the incoming Rav were as follows. He wanted 600 rubles up front. Additionally, the incoming Rav's father or father-in-law controlled some tzedakah money that was designated for people in Eretz Yisrael, and the outgoing Rav was making aliyah. So he said, part of the purchase agreement is going to be that your father-in-law will direct 50 rubles a year of that money to me. It didn't even occur to them, apparently, there was something illegitimate or improper about this deal. What happened was the outgoing Rav decided that he wanted to cancel the deal. He wasn't going to go to Eretz Yisrael because his wife doesn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. They wanted to know if the deal was binding or if he can back out of the deal. But in the course of his analysis, the Divrei Malkiel discusses, is this a legitimate deal in the first place, he says. So initially he says, this is Gezel Gomer. What's happening here? The person is buying himself a rabbinic position. The father-in-law is buying the rabbinic position for his son-in-law with tzedakah money. He's stealing tzedakah money to buy himself, to buy his son-in-law a rabbinic position. But then he says, wait. He backpedals a little bit. He implies, maybe it's not Gezel Gomer. If the recipient, the outgoing Rav, the seller of the position, is entitled to the money, he is going to be in Eretz Yisrael, according to his initial plan. Then he implies it wouldn't be Gezel Gomer. So what's wrong with it, he says? It's still Osir, he says, because the Gabbai Tzedakah, the father-in-law who's making the decision that he's a good candidate to receive the money, he's no Gabbai Tzedakah, because he's getting something of value, a rabbinic position for his son-in-law, he's no Gabbai Tzedakah, and he says that it is Yadua that Gabbai Tzedakah are Osir Lodin Bazel Levado, because it's Yadua that Gabbai Tzedakah are like the Yadu. This Yadua is basically the Trumas Hadeshin's idea that public officials, he's talking about Gabbai Tzedakah, are assumed to be like Dayanim, so therefore he can't be in a Gabbai Tzedakah. So he's trying to articulate what's wrong with taking a kickback, a tzedakah money official taking a kickback for giving tzedakah money. Initially he says it would be Gezel, but then he implicitly concedes that if the recipient is really worthy, it wouldn't be simple Gezel. So the best he can do is to say that he's no Gabbai Tzedakah, he should have to recuse himself from making the decision because he's no Gabbai Tzedakah. That's how he defines the impropriety of a kickback. In a contemporary work, the Sefer Siach Mishpat by Rav Schwartzberg, he talks about a classic kickback situation. A principal who's in charge of hiring a teacher has a stack of applications. One of the teachers, a woman applying for the position, he tells her, look, he says, according to the normal course of affairs, you'd have to wait in line. There are a lot of applications for this position. However, he says, your father, the applicant's father, controls some kind of business. He says that he has a certain business, and if he will hire my son, the son of the principal, in a senior desirable position, I will consider myself bound in gratitude to give your application precedence over the others. So the principal was taking a kickback, essentially, by securing a plum position for his son in exchange for giving hiring preference to a certain applicant, the daughter of the person who's one hand washes the other, as they say, I'll hire you if your father will hire my son. So the author of the Siach Mishpat says, this is a big problem with the Tzibur. People do this kind of thing. It's also, he says, for several reasons. First of all, he says, shochet, it's bribery. Second, he says, gnevus das. It's gnevus das. It's considered a fraud or a breach of fiduciary duty, a deception against the the employer. Why? Because if he would know that you're doing this, that you're self-dealing and taking personal gain from your from doing your job, he wouldn't hire you. It could even be Nevis Mammon, he says. If the person is not the best person for the job, he says if you're working for somebody else, and he says if you're getting, let's say, merchandise, which is not the best merchandise, or if you're not getting the best worker, he says, or not the best price, then if you take something which is less in the interest of your employer, then he says you're stealing from the Baal HaBayis. That's Nevis Mammon, he says. But even if it's not, even if the person is as suitable as anybody else, this candidate is the same as the other ones, this vendor is the same as the other ones, nevertheless, he says, it's Osir as Shochad, and it's Osir as Gnevis Das. When he explains why it's Shochad, he says, the Isser of Shochad is, if you're Mata the Din, or the Yosher, or any rule of duty, any obligation you have of behaving with Yashers because of money, because of personal gain, that's an Isser Torah of Shochad. But as we've seen, that's highly debatable. Shochad applies to Dayan. We've seen Poskim, the Chasim Sofer, and the Trumas Hadeshen, the Pulpul Charifta, and the Rosh HaShulchan, that Shochad applies to legislators, even to ordinary voters. But those are all questions of the public interest. People appointed in governmental positions, people who are voting on matters of public interest. The idea that a manager, an employee of in a private business should be subject to this or of Shochad is a tremendous chiddush, for which I'm not aware of any makar. If you work for the Department of Education and the public schools and you're hiring somebody, if you work as a public official, then yes, then this Shochad, according to the Pulpul Charifta maybe, according to the other poskim. But the idea that a manager in a private business should be subject to Shochad seems like a stretch. The other argument, Gnevis Das, so there's no obvious objection to that. Gnevis Das is a very broad term. I don't know if there is how strong a precedent there is for it, but I don't have to say for currently have accessed it, but the Gnevis Das is a broad rule. But again, it would be good if we could establish a clear precedent for the idea that a manager who takes a kickback is being over Gnevis Das. I've heard other posts can say this as well. Now, we mentioned the Divrei Malkiel and the Divrei Chaim, who both discuss cases of kickbacks, do not discuss Gneva's Das. They discuss, the Divrei Chaim and Divrei Malkiel both discuss Gneva. If you're taking money that by right should be going to the employer because you're disposing of his assets improperly or below market value, they discuss Negeva, Divrei Malkiel discusses. But the idea that it's Gneva's Das, that any time an agent takes something of value for himself without disclosing it to his employer, that's Gneva's Das. That, I think, is a significant chiddush.